Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
We've got a lot of questions on this one. People had some thoughts. Let's dive right in with a question from John. Jacob, did you read Vermis and decide that you and Alexander are now in a competition to deal the most permanent psychic damage to your audience?
That's not that far off the mark.
I just want to say that there was also a, you know, when Alexander said it goes into a category of things, there was a review recently that was, it's very nice, but it was kind of like, I still like the show, but I do wish you boys would go back to some of the other stories you used to tell.
You know, that's...
Nope.
I wrote a story about a big fish as a way of trying to do a little bit of penance. I'm trying
build
to,
bridges.
You know,
you're trying to build bridges.
I'm trying to build back. It takes twice as long to build bridges you've burned, but I'm out there with a hammer and some timber. I'm trying.
It's a real one for us, one for you situation at this point.
And I think that's fair. I think that's reasonable.
Yeah. So to answer the question, though, am I in a competition? So we talk pretty openly about how the stories that we write inspire the next stories that we write. And like reading something that Alexander wrote is often the spark for something that I'm going to write. And I know that that's true for Alexander and for Anthony as well. This is kind of a second cousin of Vermis, where I really wanted to write about rich people, but in a different way than Alexander wrote about them in Vermis. And I also took a lot from just the fact that I was like, oh, maybe we can be grosser. You know, I've been trying to write more like strictly horror stories lately, because I think it's really important for us as a, you know, ostensibly a horror podcast, but also like a weird fiction podcast. I felt like I'd gotten away from horror recently, mm-hmm. but I didn't want to write anything that felt like something that I had seen before, which is what led me to write things like Commissions Are Now Closed and what was the other one? Extinction Event. Just writing things that I thought felt unique and fresh to me, trying to like sort of entreat the muse a little bit. And
so when you're coming up with a story like Mother's Milk,
yeah,
Commissions Are Now Closed, which are both stories that are not like anything I've seen before, are you using the sort of Del Close third thought technique, or are you just stumbling across dinosaur bones and digging them up? Is there a technique you're using to try and get away from things you've done before, or is this just you find something and you have the presence of mind to latch onto it?
I think it's the difference between topic and theme, which is something I'm actually writing about for the workshop I'm putting together right now.
Mm-hmm.
Topic is, I think a lot of people write around topics. Okay. They'll pick something that they think is interesting and then they'll write about it, but mm-hmm. they won't have a theme to go along with it. And the story kind of falls apart because of that. Like,
okay.
topic could be something like time travel.
Sure.
But if you don't have a theme to go along with time travel, then you're not really, you're just writing about the topic of time travel. Like, it might as well be like, you know, a newswire story through Reuters or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I think what I get a lot of inspiration from certain topics. So I think one of the things that I've been thinking about lately is like, how do I subvert and take away the mainstream emotional connections that we have with certain things and actions? And in this case, mm-hmm. I ended up thinking about motherhood and the ways in which we care for each other. And I was also thinking a lot about psychotherapy, mm-hmm. and how psychotherapy can actually, because psychotherapy can be used for good, mm-hmm. all the ways in which you can use psychotherapy for evil.
Yeah.
And the sort of negative qualities of a bad psychotherapist. And in fact, the narrator goes to see a therapist who gives the worst possible advice. for the situation that the narrator is in. And then it mm-hmm. ends with them meeting with someone who I think it's implied in the story, but I don't outright say, but is basically a therapist. Mm-hmm. They're just like, I think I just call them a healer, which I think is that's meant. That's not me, you know, putting shade on therapists, quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. It's me separating the word, because I use the word therapist so negatively earlier in the story. I wanted it to be clear that it was a different category of person.
Yeah.
And that the word therapist had basically been like co-opted by Haustorium to yeah. represent a certain kind of mm-hmm. psyop operative. So anyway, all that is to say, I think it came from certain topics that I'd been seeing and thinking about pretty deeply in my own life, and just mm-hmm. kind of was like, how do I make the worst version of this? How do I steal all the joy from this?
Wonderful. Well, let's dig into this big pile of questions.
Yeah.
From Spike Milligan, we have, I was there when Mannequins and the Sixth Essence came out. I remember the cockroach sex episode. Mother's Milk is still easily the most disturbing thing I've ever heard from you guys, both as a mom and also just like as a regular guy. I felt so gross listening to it. Beyond the obvious, okay, but why though? I have zero questions. Excellent episode, 10 out of 10. The fact that the mother was a cis guy surprised me like a slap to the face. Well,
that's I know it's a comment.
Uh-huh.
But I do want to point out, there was no sex in the cockroach sex episode.
There certainly was not.
And everybody identifies it as the cockroach sex, which says
yes,
a lot about.
Yes, there was. Wait a second.
Says a lot.
Don't
about
gaslight
them.
The audience. Yes, there was.
What are you talking
about? Having sex with a cockroach
in a dream.
Oh, in the dream. That's not real cockroach sex.
That's not
fictional dream cockroach sex. Although that is probably the thing that they're mentioning.
I wonder if.
No.
I wonder.
No, I think they're talking about how the cockroach just has a huge human dong.
Yeah, I think that's probably.
And they are assuming that is sexual in some way. Even though in my mind, I don't know if I express this clearly in the story. In my mind, the cockroach's penis is flaccid. But
that no, I think it was pretty clear. It hangs.
It hangs. Yeah. But also the cockroach god is a shower, not a grower. So it's a little intimidating. Anyway, let's move on. Next question.
Spike, Benjamin, thank you. Thank you for staying with us.
Thanks, Spike.
Thank you for listening.
You know, we're gonna change our ways. We're gonna come to Jesus.
I will say one other thing, actually. Yes. Wait, no. Do you want to say the
please.
Thing about Sixth Essence?
No, please.
No, I just think we should expand on it. There should be a sequel.
Oh, okay. Seven Essence.
We have to like release. It has to be released to a wider audience.
That's not a bad idea. We got something to put up in the summer now.
I always like when I get to like scream.
We're gonna get more screamers for Anthony. I was gonna comment on the thing about just the mother being a cis guy. The thing I was the most worried about when writing this was that people would take this as a anti-trans episode, or that the uh-huh. horror was transness. And I was very happy that I didn't see anybody taking that message from the story, because it was kind of the opposite was my thinking. Mm-hmm. Was like, it's more about the horror of being forced to be a gender, or to have features of a gender that you do not identify with, mm-hmm. which would be make it like that. In that sense, it is actually very much a pro-trans narrative.
Yeah, it's a dysphoria story.
Exactly. But in a very, but like, it's also linked up with a bunch of other stuff. So I was concerned that people might, you know, see that aspect of it and sort of think that that's what the point of the story was, which mm-hmm. it absolutely was not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not like proud of myself for like, oh, like I dodged that bullet. It's more just like, I'm really glad that people got what I wanted out of this.
You know, I think the story is so clearly about what it's about that it's really hard to misinterpret it unless you're deliberately trying to misinterpret it because you're being paid to misinterpret it.
Like
Brian Glazer's Oscar speech.
Yeah, exactly.
Benjamin Corey asks, yes, I was so wonderfully horrified by Mother's Milk. Just the complete robbery of the main character's body and mind by someone so rich and powerful that they've created basically an entire planet to commit it to making them more wealth and power. My first question is, have any of you ever been so disturbed by a story you're trying to write that it's extremely difficult to complete? If so, how do you get past that and complete your work? Was the story at all inspired by the fact that there was a plot to lace Hitler's food with estrogen to make him more empathetic? Oh, shit.
I mean, if you're close enough to lace Hitler's food with something, you might as well just put poison in it. I don't
surely
like surely well, come must. On yeah. Or just shoot him. I don't know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I have been so disturbed by a story that I've been trying to write that it made it extremely difficult to complete. And that story was Mother's Milk. There was a part in there that was the first time that I physically was repulsed enough to like take my hands away from my keyboard. I didn't mm-hmm. like get up and like walk away, but I did take my hands off the keyboard and go,
what am I doing here?
What am I doing here? And that was a part that ended up getting pulled back a bit. I think, Anthony, you made a very good note on it. But basically the part where Dr. Paris breastfeeds was a lot more explicit mm-hmm. with the express purpose of amplifying the disgust. Uh-huh. And Anthony was like, I think we could pull it back a bit. And I was like, yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah.
And I think it was probably the right call. I don't have any regrets about it. It's more just mm-hmm. That was the moment when I sort of pulled back from writing. It felt like I'd overstepped into the realm of exploitation mm-hmm. a little bit. And mm-hmm. I don't mind doing that in some capacities, but I didn't really want to do it for this story. And what was it? Is it a plot that was inspired by? It was not inspired by that. If you actually want to know the specific thing that inspired this, mm-hmm. because we were talking about that earlier, but I didn't get to this part. The thing that specifically inspired this was the very limited, very, very small and well-boundaried empathy that I have for Elon Musk.
Interesting.
I think that the most empathetic part of my brain looks at that man and sees somebody who was very obviously abused, mm-hmm. very obviously pressured into being a certain kind of person mm-hmm. who and would never succeed in being that kind of person. There's no way to do that for your parents and especially no way from what I've heard about Elon Musk's father mm-hmm. for him to do it for his father. I imagine his mother was no picnic either.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she's awful. Okay.
So I don't even know the half of it. But
yeah.
And I think that what Elon Musk wants is so badly to have somebody who cares about him in the ways that he needs somebody to care about him right now, like mm-hmm. in his life. Like he's never had somebody care about him in that way. And the truly sad thing is that you cannot find that person. You have to be that person for yourself as an adult. Mm-hmm. And if you never received it, like that's like tough potatoes, man. But like that's what you got to do, and you got to take responsibility. And the that's where the empathy that I have for him ends.
Mm-hmm.
But
also very very responsible choice not to say tough titties there, given the subject.
Oh, honestly, I just didn't think of it. I got potatoes on the brain, and I think this very well boundaried and very small piece of empathy ends there, but I think what it led me to was the understanding of like, oh, like, you know, we all know that Elon Musk is like this really, you know, self-conscious, you know, hyper nerd mm-hmm. asshole who is just looking for someone to like him.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we understand exactly how far people like that, especially with the amount of money that they have, would be willing to go to get that.
Yeah.
This is the in my mind, the logical conclusion of a man who would spend $44 billion on Twitter
mm-hmm.
to buy Twitter just so that people would say that he was okay.
Yeah.
And the thing is like, that's never going to be enough for him in the same way that this, like the, in the story of Mother's Milk, the narrator was never going to be enough for Dr. Paris, because that's not actually what they want. They don't want to force people to say that they like them. They don't want to have so much money that the people around them are yes men who are just saying like, I love you, I care about you, you're really important and special, Elon or Dr. Paris. They don't want that. They want somebody to mean it, and nobody's mm-hmm. ever going to mean it enough for
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
And even if they are psychologically, you know, ruining somebody with this drug, it's still not going to be enough. And I think that was kind of where a lot of this came from. I just wanted to sort of, you know, take it out of the digital world of like Elon buying Twitter and turn it into and put it in a form that I think we would find more viscerally disgusting, because I think I think we should find it viscerally disgusting.
You know, I'm reminded of in in Vipassana meditation, there's a kind of meditation called metta, which means loving kindness in Sanskrit. It's loving kindness meditation. And the purpose of you sort of will meditate on, like, you know, may I be happy and healthy. May the person that I may like, my beloved, be happy and healthy. May a person that I feel neutral about be happy and healthy. May my enemy be happy and healthy. And the point of meditating on is on the point of wishing these people happiness and healthiness, or whatever positive thing you wish them in your meditation, is not to actually cultivate, you know, the feelings of positivity, maybe toxic positivity toward people who are perhaps dedicated to your destruction. The point of it is to use positive emotion as a way of opening yourself up to possibilities about the world that were mm-hmm. hidden from you before. And so this process that you're describing of sort of having this kind of radical empathy toward a person who does not deserve it, as a starting point for something really creatively fresh, I think is very interesting. And I want to think on that some more. Well, let's move on.
I was going to say one other thing about that. It's like, for me, I truly believe in rehabilitation. And I think if you're willing to extend rehabilitation to
Satan himself.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think you have to genuinely, if you believe in rehabilitation, you have to genuinely believe in it. If it's something that's actually a value, then you have to believe that it's available to everyone. And I truly do believe that, because I think that people can come back from horrible things. It doesn't mean I expect them to, but I will always leave that door open.
Mm-hmm. Every living thing contains the seed of a potential Buddha.
Yes.
From Blood Mulch, what was your favorite part of Mother's Milk to write? To narrate, that's an Anthony question. And does it take place in roughly the same universe as Hunter x Hunter? Additionally, I'm curious about this through the lens of toxic masculinity that you so often address on the show. It's easy to think of what the protagonist did as a noble choice as a father must make for his family's well-being, but in so doing, he loses attachment to his own family. There's some interesting play going on between fatherhood and motherhood in this story, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Let's start with, what was your favorite part of Mother's Milk to write?
Good question. I think my favorite part was actually a part that you wrote and I fixed. Mm-hmm. Not fixed. I edited and changed. Mm-hmm. But you wrote that you wrote a first draft of that final sequence where we sort of hear how Dr. Paris died. Initially, I left that very much in the imagination of the listener. And you wrote this fantastic, like, maybe half page, I think, something along those lines, of description of, like, you know, having the narrator imagine what happened. And because the narrator has this amount of empathy, or this you know, imprinted connection and this perfect understanding of Dr. Paris's mind, they were able to sort of piece together what it must have been like for Dr. Paris to die. And that part was I feel like that really tied the entire story together. And I really enjoyed writing. I really enjoyed revising what you had written for that. Other than that, the most fun I had was just writing the long list of desserts that the milk was used to make. I just did a bunch of research on desserts.
Milky desserts.
Anthony, was there a favorite line read that you had in here?
I wouldn't call it just a single line read, but I think that the very, very end of the story, him with sort of the, I don't know if you want to call it a village healer, just walking around the water. So often our stories end on a sense of forlornness, of there's often a feeling of loss or confusion, or, well, I guess
that dog wasn't right.
That dog wasn't right. Never knew what to make of that. And there, this one ended on, after such a horrific roller coaster, really, it really ends on a peaceful, tranquil note.
It's a lovely way the story ends.
And you don't, obviously, it's left in the air whether this the person's narrator's mind is ever going to recover. But I think you get a feeling of hope.
Yeah, that was what I wanted. And I think that comes to this thing about the lens of toxic masculinity and, you know, noble choice that a father must make for his family's well-being, that that next question from Blood Mulch, you know, loses attachment to his own family, yes, but I think that there's this key thing here about, you know, I think he takes this role thinking that he can fight the drug, you know, maybe not totally understanding what it means to be an M1 domestic. I think that that material is kept hidden and kept carefully guarded from potential applicants, because I think that these institutions, these companies are aware that once you have an M1 domestic, you don't really have to worry about telling them, you know? So once they're in, they're in. So I don't know. I sincerely doubt that the narrator had a full picture of what was going to happen. But I do think that in much the same way that I have this empathy for and this willingness to allow people to be rehabilitated, I feel the same way about the narrator, who through no fault of his own or through minor fault of his own ended up in this situation and is now trying to come back in their own way. And I think that I'm trying to leave that in the hands of the narrator at the end of the story. I think it's really important that the ending has that bit of hope, this idea that, like, you know, maybe they won't recover, but you know what? Maybe you don't need to recover from every change that happens to you. Maybe you just need to be changed by it and function from that place. Maybe trying to reverse course is not always the way forward. And I think that's sort of where I tried to end up with, like, it's a little bit of, you know, honestly, it's a little bit of acceptance and commitment therapy at the end. just the idea of, like, yeah, I am, like, I can't fix that, but I can accept it and live in accordance with my values.
Churlington Bee's Coat says,
oh, wait, there was one last thing. And does it take place in roughly the same universe as Hunter x Hunter? Yes, but I don't know the chronology. Like, okay. You and I have talked about how a lot of the Hostorium and Purple Empire stories don't really have, like, a dedicated chronology to them. And in the same way, this doesn't, I don't know, I wouldn't be able to tell you where in the chronology this would be placed, but it does, it is a shared universe timeline as Hunter x Hunter and Unbridled and a few other stories.
Yeah, I do tend to think of these stories as being these science fiction stories as being more unified within a single universe than I do with the Purple World ones. But that's a garden path that that we can go down another time.
And even then, you can though roughly cut them into, you know, future, which is to say probably from the year 2000 to 3000, and far future.
Yeah,
which is where I'd more put Hunter. Like, this story still takes place. This is still, you know, solar system level.
I think it's like terraforming, maybe, you know, near light speed travel type stuff.
Okay, from regular commenter Churlington Bee's Coat, we have, I feel that Mother's Milk presents one of, quite possibly singularly, the most ethically fucked up situation y'all have devised thus far. My question, does this sound like a fair appraisal, or did it just hit me different? My second, probably easier question is, was this a deliberate meditation on new and horrifying frontiers of slavery in the capitalist nightmare future? Or did it come from a different place and just conveniently ended up being that as well?
First question, I think this is different from the other ethically fucked up situations that we've put together. I don't think we've ever really done a story about full-on mind control or mind slavery. I think putting this in the perspective of the person being mind controlled probably made it feel worse. And sometimes I think I would naturally gravitate away from doing something like that. But in this case, I wanted to emphasize how bad this would be and how nasty it would feel. And putting you in their mind and in their head was the best way to do that. So I think it's pretty fucked up. And, like, you know, I said before, that this was the story I had the most trouble completing, just for basic, like, humanity reasons, just feeling fucking grossed out and sick and like nobody was going to enjoy this. And maybe I had gone too far.
And the second part of the question?
The second part of the question, deliberate meditation on new and horrifying frontiers of slavery in the capitalist nightmare space future. Well, you know, it didn't not come from there. I think what I said before about Elon Musk, and just applies to other billionaires in general. All of these people who are, you know, I don't think you make $1 billion because you're happy, truly. I don't think everybody makes $1 billion, but I think the people who do make $1 billion are not doing it because they, you know, they're having a good time in life. I think they probably have a lot of regrets and a lot of misery, and money is a way to, the constant accumulation of wealth is a way for them to sort of hide from that and run from that. So I think that in that sense, I think that the sort of mental slavery, this attempt to try and force people to like them is just sort of the next step in that process of making a lot of money so people will like you. Well, there's another way you can make people like you, which is forcing them to like you. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, they're not that far off from me.